So I got an email from you back in May of 2022 of correspondence between a guest and you on the show, Lloyd with the World War II helmet. And looking at the email chain between you and the guest, it sounds like you have like a roadshow pen pal.
Here's the thing, Adam. I kind of fell in love with Lloyd.
This is my boss, Marcia Bemko. Marcia first encountered Lloyd in 2021 through our Knock Our Socks Off system, or COSO for short. COSO applicants email us pictures of their treasures, and we choose which items to appraise for TV before our production begins. Normally, a tiny portion of our TV appraisals come through COSO, but thanks to COVID, 2021 was different.
We had to do the whole season as COSO that year. And so everyone who was taped had been talked to by a producer. And as it so happens, I got Lloyd.
Lloyd was 81 when he appeared on our show. And he had a World War II helmet that had been sitting in his house since he was a teenager. Here he is with an appraiser at our event in Hamilton, New Jersey in 2021.
Where did you get this helmet? I got the helmet from my grandmother. She was living in Natick, Massachusetts. And when I was about 14 years old, the family went to visit her and she had the helmet in her house. And it was actually upside down on her table in her living room with dirt in it and a flower growing out of it.
So he got this one from his grandmother. She just had it as a flower pot.
That's right. Yeah. And he did not believe the stories about his uncle when they were told. He just took them with a grain of salt because they were so of such a hero.
She said, well, that helmet belonged to your father's uncle. It was her brother. And she started telling me things about his exploits in the Navy. And one of the first things she said was that he was the first naval officer to land on Normandy. And she then started talking about him being involved in helping develop plans for the assault on Normandy. And I thought, how much of this can you come up with?
Still, when his grandmother offered him the helmet, Lloyd took it home. He played with it, and so did his sisters and later his kids. They wore it for Halloween and brought it to school for show and tell. It was just a cool artifact to have around the house, but that's really all it was. A cool object from a great uncle who might have had something to do with D-Day. But then, around 2018, Lloyd happened to mention the helmet to a neighbor. I asked him about it.
We were selling the house and we had a yard sale. Some man came in and asked if I had any military items. And I said, well, yeah, I have an old helmet that belonged to my great uncle. And he said, well, he'd like to see it sometime. So about, 3 or 4 months after we'd moved, I finally called him. He said, I've been waiting for your call. He says, I'd like to see that helmet. So I showed it to him and he looked at it and he says, you don't know what you have here.
If you go to our event, you'll see a lot of people walking around with World War II helmets. It's just a numbers thing. Everybody's got a helmet in their family at some point.
Yep.
That doesn't make it valuable. It has to, have a history like this one. Jeff Schrader describes it as a unicorn. This is a unicorn of a helmet.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty amazing thing. It was on his head at the beach on that day, and then it was in Hamilton.
I'm Adam Monahan, a producer with GBH's Antiques Roadshow, and this is Detours. Today, to Utah Beach and back. The Atlas Obscura podcast is your definitive guide to the world's hidden wonders. A village in India where everyone's name is a song. A boiling river in the Peruvian Amazon. A spacecraft cemetery in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Every day, the Atlas Obscura podcast transports you to a real place in the world that will surprise and amaze you. Like and subscribe to the Atlas Obscura podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Funding for Detours comes from American Cruise Lines, proud sponsor of Antiques Roadshow. On a journey with American Cruise Lines, travelers experience the maritime heritage and culture of the Maine coast and New England islands. Their fleet of small cruise ships explore American landscapes, seaside villages, and historic harbors, where you can experience local customs and cuisine. To learn more, visit AmericanCruiseLines.com. Ancestry can help you discover your origins, build a family tree, and search historical records, giving you more ways to learn about your family's past and connect over their stories. Visit Ancestry.com to learn more. It was 1944. Germany was occupying France, and the Allied forces were trying to figure out how they could get their troops on the ground to boot the Nazis out. First off, they needed a place to land. Their best options were either too heavily defended or too geographically complex. They settled on a 50-mile stretch of the Normandy coastline. They'd invade five beaches, codenamed Omaha, Juno, Gold, Sword, and Utah. Next, they needed good weather.
If you're going to do a parachute drop, you have to have moonlight. Otherwise, there are going to be an awful lot of guys with broken legs because they didn't know when the ground was coming up.
They picked June 5th, 1944, a night with an almost full moon and hopefully clear sky. Now they needed to figure out how to get all the troops and their stuff, food, water, ammunition, vehicles, from the sea and air to the land. More than 160,000 troops were going to land on these five beaches. It was the largest seaborne invasion in history.
Any history nerd will tell you, you know, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics, and the miracle at D-Day, the thing that made that whole operation work, was all of the work that they did to develop the system whereby supplies would be landed ashore. All of these factors had to line up just right in order to make this giant machine work. And so then, morning of June 6th, the weather's terrible. They had canceled the day before, postponed. They decided to do it on this night, and the weather was actually worse. It probably would have been better going the day before, but it worked.
Lloyd's grandma had told him that his great uncle was the first naval officer to land on Normandy and that he helped to plan the D-Day invasion. But in the 6 decades since he brought the helmet home, Lloyd never knew if any of that was true. That changed when his helmet aficionado neighbor pointed out the special markings, including an eagle on the front. That eagle meant that the person who wore it was a naval captain. So Lloyd started researching to see what else he could learn.
I had a cousin come in with her husband, and he was in the service. He got on his phone, and within 2 minutes, he had a picture of my great uncle standing under the flag at Utah Beach.
The uncle's name, he found, was Captain James Arnold. And Lloyd wasn't the only one researching him. He soon got a message on Facebook from a volunteer at a museum in France.
Apparently what had happened was people were trying to reorganize things at the Airborne Museum, and they found a box full of stuff. And they started looking through it and said, this isn't airborne, this is Navy stuff.
The Airborne Museum figured out that the items had to do with Utah Beach, so they passed them along to the Utah Beach Landing Museum. A volunteer there started to research the material, found it belonged to Captain Arnold, and connected with Lloyd and some other family members to see what other information and material they could find.
One of his daughters is still alive. She ended up donating a pair of binoculars that had belonged to him. And then through the grandson, he had records that my uncle had started to write an autobiography. And we found secret documents that had been declassified that he had signed, which were keeping track of all of the Jeeps and tanks and equipment that was being brought ashore. And I got just more and more interested in what he had done and what he was involved with.
How did you come to bring this item to Antiques Roadshow?
Well, my daughter had always been interested in what it might be worth. So she suggested that I apply. And then we found out that because COVID had just hit, that things were being canceled. So that was the end of it.
A year later, Lloyd's daughter saw that our show would be coming to Hamilton, New Jersey, which was driving distance from Lloyd's home in upstate New York. Now, the way our show usually works is that ticketed guests come with items from home. The items go to a specific category table. For instance, Lloyd's helmet would go to Militaria, and appraisers decide which items they want to pitch to a producer to be on TV. But this was our all COSO season, so Lloyd and everyone else applied online, and the process was done remotely to decide which items would be appraised in front of our cameras in Hamilton, New Jersey. Lloyd's helmet went to the inbox of one of our arms and military appraisers, Jeff Schrader.
When I saw that photo come across my screen, I couldn't believe the good fortune. This is one of those things that if it walks up to your table, you have to pause a little bit and compose yourself before you interact with the guest.
Jeff had seen a lot of World War II helmets by the time Lloyd's helmet came across his screen. But no matter how good something seems, he's always skeptical.
World War II helmets were made in the millions. They're very plain. They're exciting in their own little, you know, helmet nerd kind of way. There are various minute differences that tell you when during World War II a helmet was made. And there's enough meat there to get collectors interested. But really, the thing that gets them going are the specific markings that were painted on helmets for their use in the various invasions and operations. And that little splash of paint oftentimes is the difference between a $100 or $200 World War II helmet and something that is worth potentially thousands of dollars.
So Jeff was looking at this helmet, trying to figure out if the markings, like that eagle on the front, were genuine, or if they were painted on later, maybe by a hobby reenactor, or maybe by an opportunistic forger.
The standing joke in the military community is this was found in a barn in Normandy. Apparently the barns in Normandy are just overflowing with the most amazing things. You know, it's Aladdin's cave, each and every one of them.
Of course, this helmet wasn't found in a barn in Normandy. It was found in a living room in Natick, Massachusetts. But even when a helmet stays in the family, the stories that get passed down with it aren't always accurate.
Sometimes these things get associated simply by proximity. You know, you were Uncle Joe's kid and Uncle Joe did this and this helmet happened to be in his garage, therefore it's Uncle Joe's helmet. Well, maybe, maybe not. But this had a ring of authenticity to it.
When Jeff saw the helmet in person, he quickly verified that everything Lloyd had heard about it was true. Those helmet nerd markings made that abundantly clear. Here he is during the appraisal.
And we have an early production World War II M1 helmet. And the reason why we can tell that that is early is the seam for the brim that goes around the edge of the helmet is in the front. At the very end, that's moved to the back. And then the loops that suspend the chin strap are fixed in place. And then, of course, we've got the captain's eagle insignia right there on it.
Jeff flips the helmet over to show that Captain Arnold's name is written on the inside, and then spins it around and points to the block printed letters USN for United States Navy.
These specific designated markings told everybody around you what the person who was wearing that helmet was there to do. Mm-hmm. On this particular helmet, there is a specific designator here in the front, NOIC, Naval Officer in Charge. So he's Naval Officer in Charge at Utah. There aren't very many of those helmets. He would not have been the only one. His deputy and the other people on his staff there with him would have had similar helmets or similar markings. Mm-hmm. But he's the only guy there with the captain's eagle on his helmet.
Oh, really?
So there is but one of these.
And in case that wasn't enough to prove this helmet's importance, Lloyd brought one more piece of evidence.
you have a copy of an original photograph of your uncle very, very clearly wearing that helmet. And this has to have been on June 6th. He's still wearing his invasion life belt.
Oh.
All of this material adds up to a stellar example of provenance, a record of ownership that proves the item we're seeing is what it claims to be.
What most folks think of as provenance is actually oral tradition. You know, so oral tradition is an industry term that is a nice way to say probably bullshit. This is provenance. This you could go stand before a judge and have 100% confidence.
So the helmet was definitely 100% real and 100% amazing. And what made it amazing was the guy who wore it, Captain James Arnold, a Navy officer who played a crucial role during the Normandy invasions in World War II.
He was in charge of making, not only essentially being a traffic cop and getting the landing craft in, the landing craft out, getting people to the right place, getting supplies to the right place, and doing all of this while under fire. It's pretty spectacular. And he had a pivotal role to play there on D-Day, and the world frankly benefited.
So that's what Lloyd and Jeff knew about Captain Arnold's role on D-Day when Lloyd came to our event in 2021. But Lloyd wasn't the only one talking to the Utah Beach Landing Museum. They had also contacted a museum in Natick, Massachusetts to learn more about Captain Arnold's life and share Captain Arnold's own accounts of the war.
I know the helplessness of lying in a foxhole while air bombs drop and the fear of seeing men blown to bits by bursting shells. But also, I have seen in the last few weeks more pleasant things to remember. An army which has no equal in the world.
That's coming up after the break. All right. Can you introduce yourself and your title?
I'm Nikki Lefebvre, and I'm the executive director of the Natick Historical Society.
Nikki and I spoke at the Natick Society Museum, where she filled me in on when they first became aware of the extraordinary life of Captain James Arnold.
So we learned about Captain Arnold through Guillaume Moreau, who was a history teacher connected with the Utah Beach Landing Museum. And really, he reached out to us hoping that we would have more material to share with him so that he could tell Arnold's story. And we thought, wait a minute, you know, we don't have material on this person. And so we began our own research to see what else we could find about his life and his story.
And what are some of the more interesting things that you could share with him from your research?
Right. So James Arnold, you know, was born in Vermont, and he did his undergraduate work at WPI in Worcester, and then he went on to the Naval Academy. But he comes to Natick sort of later in life in the 1930s and 40s. He has a family, has two kids here, and he lives on Park Avenue, right, which those of us who live in Natick today know. And he works in Boston for the Leland Gifford Company. And he's a salesman and he's an engineer, you know, really drawing on those skill sets that I think he honed at WPI and then probably as a naval officer as well. And what's really remarkable about Arnold is that in 1933, he runs for elected office and he becomes a representative in the State House of Massachusetts. So he's a well-known and leading figure in the Natick community of the 1930s. And he remains an officer in reserve throughout his life. He's part of the sort of Naval Academy Officers Club in Boston. He remains connected to it during this time in the 30s and 40s. But he comes back in the 40s and wow, is he ever given a job for all jobs.
So Captain Arnold had stayed an officer from World War I until he was called back to active duty in 1940. He spent a few years close to home overseeing Navy shipbuilding in Quincy, Massachusetts. And then he was sent to Europe to prepare for the D-Day invasion. The Natick Museum shared their learnings with the Utah Beach Museum, and Utah Beach shared some incredible documents of their own.
We do sort of research on genealogies and house histories and that sort of thing. So we had a kind of exchange, you know, our local materials, right, that are very Natick specific, and he had the diary.
Captain Arnold had kept a diary during his time in World War II. Seeing those entries brought this historical figure to life.
He was this incredible commander, and he was also human. And diaries have this really compelling way of showing you the many sides of a person.
Nikki read me an excerpt.
I have lived in wet clothes for days and gone without a bath for weeks. I know the helplessness of lying in a foxhole while air bombs drop and the fear of seeing men blown to bits by bursting shells. I know the experience of eating K-rations out of a paper and can remember some of the days when I didn't eat at all and didn't seem hungry. I have felt the urge to kill and keep killing and the horror of badly wounded men, some hopelessly hurt making little whimpering noises like a whipped little boy. And I know the feeling of loneliness for family and home, which is one of the most hopeless of all the sicknesses. But also, I have seen in the last few weeks more pleasant things to remember. Good men standing by good officers, an army which has no equal in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, to go through that type of experience and see the horrible things in nature and then try to reflect on the good, too.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really... what was that like when these types of materials, they come to you from France?
I mean, goosebumps, right? I mean, it's just, it's very moving because I think it's easy to celebrate Arnold and all of his achievements and also easy to forget that he was a human. And when he writes about his loneliness and homesickness, you know, that really gets me every time because it's an ailment that doesn't have a cure until you can come home, right? And I think it also shines a light on the complexity of feelings of people who are nonetheless incredibly brave, right? That they're not superhuman, but they are able to meet the moment, and that's extraordinary.
Why is Captain Arnold's story so important to the Natick Museum?
History tends to sometimes feel like it's way back there or way out there, it's in a book, but if you can tap into one human who had an extraordinary experience, who documented that experience, who artifacts that touched that experience survived, right? That really creates a kind of intimacy with that historical moment that I think is just critical to our own sense of identity, our connection to each other, to the past, to the future. It's just a huge part of what makes local history so important.
When Lloyd brought Captain Arnold's helmet to our event, he already knew a lot there was to know about his uncle's achievements. What he didn't know was how valuable his helmet was.
If I was cataloging this for an auction, I would put an estimate on the item between 30 and 40,000.
Wow. I can't believe that. Pretty expensive flower pot.
I have every confidence that at a good sale, that number would be eclipsed.
Can't imagine.
It's a real unicorn in the World War II collecting realm. It's something that represents a fantastically important human endeavor, one that had an impact on the lives of millions of people. I mean, there are people in Europe alive today that would not have been had your uncle not have been so good at his job.
Yeah, I'm quite proud of him. And I mean, the helmet itself didn't do an awful lot. It was the man wearing it. And I'm very proud to be related to him, part of the family.
This is one of the most valuable objects that you've ever appraised since you've been on our show. You valued it at $30,000 to $40,000 retail at the time. Do you think that estimate would be the same today?
Absolutely. If it wasn't strictly against the rules to buy things, which everybody, it is, we can't do that as appraisers. We are strictly forbidden. But if Lloyd had turned to me and said, would you give me $30,000 for this right now? I would have done it in cash right there.
Now that Lloyd knew how important and valuable his uncle's helmet was, he had to figure out what to do with it.
And I had determined that I was going to have the helmet on display, and I had determined that it should be over at the Utah Beach Landing Museum.
The helmet would go right back to the beach where Captain Arnold had landed. Lloyd made plans to deliver it to the Utah Beach Landing Museum on the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. The first day of their tour, they visited the Airborne Museum, where Captain Arnold's materials had first turned up, and drove along the area of Utah Beach where Captain Arnold and the troops were supposed to have landed.
That was Saturday. Saturday night, I went to bed. I had a sore throat.
Oh, no.
And in the morning, my daughter says, you know, Dad, if you're not feeling well, we should probably tell the folks on the tour. So they gave us a COVID test, and I tested positive, which meant that I couldn't get out of the place for 5 days.
Lloyd missed the 75th anniversary celebration. When he was finally cleared, he set up another date to visit the beach and hand off the helmet. There was one spot in particular he wanted to see.
Well, he had written an article for one of the Navy publications back in 1947, and he mentions that he got ashore with his Jeep driver, and they were on the beach and were being shot at. So he went, he found a shell crater, and he jumped into it. And while he was in this shell crater, he said that somebody else jumped in with him and said, I'm Teddy Roosevelt. And he says, and I know you, you're Arnold from the Navy. So Teddy Roosevelt Jr. had jumped in with him. And because the group had been pushed further down the beach than they had expected, Teddy Roosevelt jumps up and says, we're going to start the war from here. And it was all determined from the foxhole that they were sitting in.
Brigadier General Teddy Roosevelt Jr. was the eldest son of President Teddy Roosevelt, and he led the first wave of the invasion on Utah Beach. Roosevelt died of a heart attack a month after the invasion at 56 years old and was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. Lloyd carried the helmet to that spot on the beach and then delivered it to the mayor, whose father had founded the Utah Beach Landing Museum.
So he gave me a medallion that his father had designed, and it was given to honorary people. It was indicating that I was a special citizen of Utah Beach. And that was very touching.
Do you know how long you'll keep it there?
Unless at some point the family takes it back, it's going to be there forever.
I think it's really generous of you to put it on loan there, because that's a spectacular item that deserves to be seen, and so that people can learn about your great uncle's contributions to the effort. Marcia already knew what Lloyd had done with the helmet. In fact, she was the person who brought this story to me. She stayed in touch with Lloyd this whole time.
After we talked, he started writing to me, sending me pictures. And then it got personal. We started to talk about personal things. You know, he's like my pen pal.
The correspondence that you had forwarded to me back in May of 2022 was all about the voyage of what happened after this. Why don't you tell us what you remember from that correspondence?
Well, I know he loaned it to a museum over there. And if you're going to ask me the name of the museum, it's enough months ago that I don't remember. Is it the D-Day Museum or something?
It's the Utah Beach Landing Museum in St. Marie Dumont was in touch with him. And he wound up putting it on loan to the museum.
So here's my selfish, curious question. In the description on the helmet in the museum, does it talk about it appearing on Antiques Roadshow?
I'm just going to say I'm not researching that. But here's a people in France, if you get this, please just add Antiques Roadshow to the little plaque.
Yeah, hey, we have an edit suggestion for your plaque.
Detours is a production of GBH in Boston and distributed by PRX. This episode was written and produced by Galen Beebe. Sound designed and mixed by Jack Pombriant. Our assistant producer is Sarah Horatius, and our senior producer is Ian Koss. Jocelyn Gonzalez is the director of PRX Productions. Devin Maverick Robbins is the managing producer of podcasts for GBH. Marcia Bemko is the executive producer of Detours. I'm your host and co-executive producer, Adam Monahan. Our theme music is Once in a Century Storm by Will Daly from the album National Throat. Thank you all for listening. Have a good one.
GBH.